Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Think for a moment of your most memorable experience in an art museum. Chances are it was a moment of quiet contemplation or revelation. Just you, a work of art, and all the intimacy and life of its details, the colors, lines, and textures. Those moments are still possible, but these days museums and their coffers can't rely on the lure of a single masterpiece to draw the crowds. They know that the masses move for the blockbusters, El Greco, Rembrandt, the treasures of Tutankhamun. Financial realities and artistic aspirations have always had touchy relations. Consider the director of Boston's Museum of Fine Art's recent and controversial decision to rent Monet's from his museum's permanent collection to a hotel gallery in Las Vegas. The deal is worth millions, money the museum can use. But something about it doesn't sit well with many in the art world. So what's a museum to do? It's one of the questions in a new book edited by James Kuno. He's wondering where the art museum is headed after the buzz and the flash of the go-go 90s. We'd like to know what you think, what you want your art museum to be. Would you prefer that it remain a hall of rare treasures and leave those T-shirts and posters to the sidewalk vendors, or is there room for both and more in today's art museum? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me today, two top museum directors. James Kuno is director at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. He's joining us from the BBC studios there. Jim, it's good of you to be with us.
Thank you very much.
And you've got a new job. You're off to the Art Institute of Chicago, I understand.
Yes, that's right. At the end of summer or early September.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
The book that Jim has written is called Whose Muse? Art Museums and the Public Trust. We'll be talking about that and other issues on the program today. Malcolm Rogers is here with me in the Boston studio. He is director of the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. Malcolm, it's good of you to be here.
It's good to be here.
Can I ask you for your thoughts on the word that Jim uses in the title of his book, public trust? What is the public trust that you have as a museum director?
The public trust we have, I think, goes back to the spirit and the inspiration of our first founders in the 19th century, who saw museums as being founded for the general benefit of the public good. And the thing that exercises directors in every generation is how do you fulfill the expectation of the public good?
And when you look at that over time, does it change? Has the definition of the public trust changed through time?
I think it has, and I'm not sure that it should altogether. Something that I feel happened very much in the 20th century was that museums became a little more inward-looking as they were professionalized, and that now many of us are trying creatively to make them more outward-looking and looking towards that original public trust that our founders had.
What do you mean by inward-looking and outward-looking?
Inward-looking, I see the overall mission of museums as bringing art and people together. Museums were probably founded by an intellectual and social elite, but they were founded for everyone. And I feel one of the great things that we do as part of the democratic process is bring as many people of all classes and all societies together to introduce them to what is the miraculous quality of great art. And it truly is miraculous, and it can change people's lives.
Jim Kuno, the public trust. What were you trying to get at in your collection of essays in this new book? How do you define the public trust?
Well, I think the public trust, much as Malcolm said, is a contract between the public and the public institution, and the basis, I guess, for the authority that a public institution has to carry out its work on behalf of and for the public. It's what gives authority to the museum. To take up the public's call for the museum to perform these certain functions on its behalf.
And would you agree with the suggestion that I raised at the beginning of the program that one of the difficulties of that now is figuring out how to fulfill the public trust, how to get the money to fulfill the public trust without necessarily crossing whatever lines you choose to set as the director of an art museum?
Well, I'm sure that's a challenge now. It's no... I don't know if it's more of a challenge now than it has ever been. Museums are expensive. One needs to raise the money to make it possible to carry out their functions. But what we wanted to do in the book was to really offer the book and these sets of thoughts about this concept of public trust as a reminder of what museums must do and how they can uniquely contribute to our civic life. And And this concept of the public trust, just for just a second, is to think about it as something that was borrowed, so far as I know, from family law, that is, the principle by which current assets are set aside and held in trust for future generations, and that this binds the trustees of that trust, the public trust, to work on behalf of the trust beneficiaries and not on themselves. And we just wanted to remind museums, thinking that we museums might have had misplaced priorities in these go-go years, as you described them, to remind them of this basic contract, this almost covenant with the public, which is the trust that museums hold, the authority given by that trust.
Let's talk about stuff that's in the news right now. And we won't spend the hour talking about Monet in Las Vegas, but it's a good one to raise in context of this, Malcolm. The art critic with the L.A. Times, Christopher Knight, refers to your decision to rent those paintings as baldly inappropriate. You have taken a beating over this.
Well, it raises the visibility of what we're doing. I see good precedents for it in a way. It's very interesting that throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s, American museums, indeed American museums around the world, have been very happily at sending exhibitions of great works of art to Japanese department stores in exchange for a fee. Often it was said, well, department stores were the only place to send art. Of course, that was the pretext. But in fact, looking at Las Vegas, America's fastest growing city with a very small share of the nation's art resources, it seemed to me entirely appropriate to send art to that environment, to one of the few galleries that is available there for the showing.
So the fact that it's one of the tackiest places in the country is in fact an argument for sending the art there rather than an argument for withholding
it? It's somewhat tacky, but it's also a vibrant place, I have to say, and a growing place, and it has just the needs of any growing city. I mean, on the first day the exhibition opened, let me give you two anecdotes. To see parties of school kids going into the exhibition, like school kids in any city in America, and enjoying it, that's wonderful. And another anecdote, I remember the weatherman in Las Vegas on the TV interrupting his broadcast to say, we are so pleased to have Monet here. And who are these art snobs to say we shouldn't have him here?
So in your, but from your point of view, was it about renting the paintings to make the money to do what it is that you want at the Museum of Fine Art? Or is it about getting art out to the people?
It's two things. It is wonderful that we can earn some income from that, of course. You know, the MFA employs 1,000 Bostonians. We're a major employer here, and these are difficult times. So it's wonderful to generate income. But it's also fantastic to make sure our works of art, really great works of art, are seen by a national, an international public in a city that's deprived of art, and they're taken out of store. The bulk of those paintings were in store. And I think
not
when they're in
seen.
Store, they're dead.
Jim Kuno, let me hear from you on this. If I draw a line in the middle of my page and say you're either in favor of an idea like this or against it, where would you come down?
Well, I would be cautious. I don't know the circumstances within which Malcolm and trustees made their decision, but I would be cautious, not only because it's the trustees and directors' responsibility to increase and strengthen the assets of the museum, which is, of course, not just simply its cash flow, but rather its reputation and the public's trust in the museum. And I would be cautious about the secondary effects of the loan of these pictures to a place that might diminish in the eyes of many and many at home, perhaps the dignity of the institution. And I know that Malcolm and trustees must have weighed that very, very seriously and made a very careful decision on this part and probably were just as cautious as I would be. But it is something that I would be very cautious about, because one has a responsibility not only to the physical objects, which I'm sure Malcolm and trustees took into account in making these decisions, but they are, because of their location, and that location in Boston is subsidized by the taxpayers of Boston indirectly through the tax benefits that occur in around museums. They have a certain responsibility to those people and to these pictures and their assets. And when they're in Las Vegas, they're lost, of course, to not only the public of Boston, but to the opportunity for those pictures to be in exhibitions elsewhere that might advance, in effect, our knowledge and knowledge.
What would be the difference if you called up Malcolm and said, I'd love to have a couple of those Monets for the Courtauld Institute, and could I have them for a show that I'm planning on doing? In that case, you're also taking them away from people in Boston. What's the difference?
I think the difference is that we would request these pictures for a particular reason, not just to show them and to share them with the public, wherever they might be, whether it's in a private institution and a for-profit institution, as I believe, I may be wrong, but as I believe the case of the institution in Las Vegas is, or whether it's in a public institution, we would want to be able to ask for these pictures because they provide a unique opportunity to advance our understanding and our knowledge about these pictures, not just simply to show them because they are not otherwise visible here, but rather to advance our particular knowledge because the world's a big place and people do travel around the world. Pictures don't have to travel as often or as frequently as they have. So it would want to be a very clear reason for exhibiting these works and asking for their loan.
I find what Jim says fascinating, and I agree with a great deal of what he says. But one of the things that I was talking about in terms of the professionalization of museums in the 20th century is that in the context of exhibitions, the organizing of exhibitions, it's so often seen that exhibitions have to have an intellectual justification for them within the museum profession, that they advance scholarship. And yet to me, and it's true of any museum's permanent collection, just putting a beautiful work of art on the wall with decent explanation for the public to look at, whether it's in Boston or in another city, also advances the cause of education much, much more broadly.
Okay, but a couple of questions here. Now, mm-hmm. if I was independently wealthy and said, look, here's $10 million, I'd like to rent a Monet to hang in my living room. Now, there, you get the money for your coffers, but you don't necessarily get the exposure. Would you do it?
We don't do it. And nor would I do it. I'm very much concerned. It's central to this issue of the public trust that we really want the broad public to see the works of art that we hold in trust.
So if I was running a Walmart and said, I can give you the security that you want and the lighting that you might want to have these showcased, but I'm a Walmart, would you do it?
Well, we would think about it. I mean, as I said to you, it's perfectly plain that American museums have been doing this in department stores in Japan. I mean, most of the major household name museums were doing that and would still be doing it if the Japanese economy were healthier. We've actually in Boston taken a different tack there. We've ceased to do exhibitions with department stores, and we have our own outstation museum in Japan in the city of Nagoya, which I think is a much, much better thing to do. But you take the resources that are available to you at a particular time and make the best you can of it.
All right, we have to take a short break here, and it's a chance for Connection listeners to go to their phones, 1-800-423-8255. What do you think about what you're hearing? What is the public trust? Where should that art be seen? What responsibility does the director of an art museum have to decide where the art should be seen, how the art should be seen? How do you define the public trust? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about what's in a museum, what's outside a museum, and what responsibility the directors have of those museums to take care of the art. What is their public trust? James Cuno is with us. He is director of the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. He's also a professor there, editor and contributor to a new collection of essays called Who's Muse? Art Museums and the Public Trust. Malcolm Rogers is here with me in our Boston studio. He's director of the Museum of Fine Arts in his 10th year in charge of that museum, formerly deputy director and deputy keeper of the National Portrait Gallery in London. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you join us. Let's take our first call from Boston. Steve's joining us. Steve, thanks for calling.
Oh, Thank you. I'm really glad you're having this show. First of all, I would say as an artist in Boston, what a museum means to me is something a little bit different than described. It's a place a person goes to really have maybe somewhat of a spiritual connection with the work, distancing themselves from the real world of marketing and the real world of products and things that are maybe just that could be interesting but aren't to me necessarily developing that spiritual connection. And in that, in thinking about this for quite some time and talking about it with friends, I feel the artists themselves can make a difference in the museum world by saying to people, maybe at the MFA, you know, Malcolm Rogers, that we don't necessarily feel we want to show our work at the MFA. I can't say that, you know, 100%, but I'm starting to feel like last year I showed my work at the De Cordova Museum, which I feel is such a beautiful place. But when it comes to the MFA, I feel like I don't want to show my work when it's put next to a Ford Fairlane or a picture of Jack Nicholson or something like that. It diminishes my feeling about my work. And I think the MFA has a lot of work of deceased artists, but as living artists, we can also kind of reshape the museum and maybe take a look at that.
Well, if you come to the museum at the moment, you can see our wonderful Travelling Scholars exhibition, which shows the work of living artists, graduates of our museum school. And I have to say, they're not seen in the context of Ford cars or advertising propaganda. They're seen in a gallery next door to works by John Singer Sargent or Kiki Smith. And I would say in conditions of extreme beauty and elegance, and where you can achieve that meditative spirit and spiritual quality that you're looking for. Visit the museum. I think you haven't been there recently. You're listening to the propaganda.
If Malcolm, you were to pull together a display, an exhibition of the craftsmanship that goes into furniture or guitars or was it motorcycles at the Guggenheim?
Guggenheim did motorcycles,
yeah,
I believe. Yes.
Then do you have a responsibility to separate that somehow? I mean, I think that's in part what Steve's talking about here, but I'm wondering if in your own decision to say, let's do this, you need to say, let's put it over here so, you know, we don't have the Titian hanging right next to the Harley Davidson.
Well, we always have quiet places. Of course, all museums have quiet places and places of great spirituality. But I also think that one of the things museums have to do is uncover the beauty in unexpected places to make people look more carefully at objects that they've taken for granted, whether it's an exhibition, say, of kitchen chairs, mm-hmm. or shoes or the decorative arts. We've just had a wonderful exhibition of American craft furniture from the second half of the 20th century. But to make people look more carefully, more closely at things and realise the beauty and the craftsmanship, that can be found in some objects that are despised. I don't believe looking afresh at new things disrupts the overall harmony of what is a great universal museum. I really don't believe it.
Jim Cuno, what do you think?
Well, I want to take it to a slightly different place, the conversation, because the book and what we meant to do by the book was not only to talk about modes of display of works of art. And I don't want the book to be sort of caricatured, not that it has been in this program, but I don't want it to be caricatured as somehow only suggesting that works of art ought to be seen on their own in a temple of sort of meditative reverie. But rather, on the matter of public trust, we wanted to offer a case for museums in a sort of polemical way, to be honest, but nevertheless, a case that museums would be serving the public good if, for example, like a land trust, they were only to acquire works of art. That is, the responsibility a museum has to its public, the public that is both living and yet to be born, is to choose from all those works of art that are out there in the world, those few that it believes deserve being set aside for all of time to be protected and preserved, so that that living legacy, that long living legacy that the museums have to offer the future visitors to museums, is to be richer, made richer by it. And so we wanted to be sure that acquisition was not lost in the excitement over temporary exhibitions, which had, over the course of the 90s, come to be so prominent in the identity of museums.
So are you saying no to the motorcycle or yes to the motorcycle?
Well, in the specific case of the motorcycle, it depends on what your collection is, because temporary exhibitions, in my view, ought to derive from or complement in some way, lead the visitor back to the temporary exhibition and whether or to the permanent,
collection. Yeah.
And whether the motorcycle actually leads someone back to the chair, for example, I don't know. But if you were at the Museum of Modern Art, where you had a very rich collection of design, a design that would include a Bell helicopter or include an automobile, as well as it includes architects' models and chairs and industrial equipment and so forth. That would be a home to see a motorcycle. If you didn't have that, didn't have a sufficiently rich context, then I think it would sit alone as something else, as something chosen perhaps for other reasons. And so it depends, really. The Guggenheim didn't, in that case, have a context for showing the motorcycles. MoMA does. So motorcycles by themselves, as such, are not a problem to me. It just depends the context, the reason one does the exhibition.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Roslindale, Massachusetts now. Suzanne's on the line. Suzanne, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking the call.
What do you think?
I think that being a member of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, that the world has come to a place where an MBA is almost more valuable than an art history degree in some instances for directors of museums. It is a business, and these blockbusters that have gone throughout the 90s pay for other very academic pursuits. And they also attract a crowd who know Monet's name and will come to see the Monet show, but then will walk through. So I understand the academic pursuit of the museums. And also the MFA in Boston, as I understand it, is a private institution as opposed to a publicly funded institution. So they might have a little bit more leeway what they're able to show and not show their reasons for it. But I can appreciate the larger shows to pay for the other smaller shows or even acquisitions of classical works.
All right, Jim Cuno. That seems to make sense. You don't actually have to go and see the treasures of Tutankhamun at your museum if you choose not to line up and feel that you're being rushed through. But if it brings in a few $100,000 for your director to pick up a painting that she's had her eye on, why not?
Well, we have to be accurate about this. I think that even if a museum does not receive a direct subsidy from the government, and that government be the city, county, state, or federal government, it doesn't mean it's not a public institution. It sits on tax-free land. It's the beneficiary of gifts that are themselves tax-free. There's a tremendous amount of tax subsidy in our country, that is in the United States, for our museums. And for that reason, if only for that reason, museums have this responsibility to the public. And that responsibility, as I said earlier, is a complex one. It's not just the responsibility to show works of art, but it's to retain and strengthen and deepen the collection, the staff, the endowment, the authority the institution has, its reputation. And so you want to make all those decisions in the light of that very grave responsibility. We think, those of us who contributed to this book, that the museum work is serious work. It's important work. I know Malcolm shares the same. But we were afraid, in the context of all the go-go excitement of the 90s and the emphasis on temporary exhibitions, that some of the seriousness of purpose of museums was being lost, and we wanted to remind people of this very serious responsibility that we have.
Okay, I'm still looking for your answer to my question about whether or not the flashy exhibition that brings in lots of people doesn't in fact allow you the money to pursue that work of holding that public trust.
It depends, of course, on what the exhibition is. You can have, and two great examples of exhibitions that wouldn't be described by anyone as flashy, but nevertheless were enormously popular and enormously learned and very, very beautiful. One of them was the Renaissance Tapestry Exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, in which these exceedingly rare things that hadn't been seen by anyone in the group of the selection as they were shown attracted enormous crowds of people. It was a hugely successful exhibition. And equally here right now in London in the last few days, a Renaissance Illuminated Manuscript Exhibition with most beautiful, small, attractive things has brought great crowds of people who spend a great deal of time with magnifying glasses looking over these things. You can achieve success. Van Gogh, Gauguin at Chicago, to name a third exhibition, very scholarly, important, beautiful exhibition. You can do that on the terms of that scholarly, great, important, beautiful exhibition. You needn't do other kinds of exhibitions just simply to get that money in. You might more easily get that money by just seeking a gift from an individual.
Malcolm.
I totally agree with Jim on this. I don't think that necessarily the very popular exhibitions are flashy. I don't believe that for a moment. A classic example of this is our own Gauguin Tahiti exhibition, which is just about to open. We expect enormous audiences, new scholarship, incredibly scholarly throughout everything that's done with that exhibition, and it's something any museum could be absolutely proud of. To me, as I run the museum, what I look for is the balance between very popular exhibitions and less popular exhibitions. The popular exhibitions allow us financially to do some of those more minority exhibitions that are just as close to our mission. I'd make one other point, that the talk of exhibitions does bring us back to one of the great themes of the public trust, and one of the challenges for the museum world these days, and I think Jim would agree with me on this, is how do we bring back people to what we call, so rather boringly, I think, our permanent collections. Exhibitions are wonderful. They often stimulate new ideas, present new scholarship, but the treasures on the walls are just as important, just as magnetic, and we do have a duty to find ways of reinventing our so-called permanent galleries to make them more magnetic, and that's what really great directors and staffs are working on at the moment.
But the tough thing is, it's easy to get a corporate sponsor to get behind something like Gauguin, harder to get a corporate sponsor to get behind a decision to bring something out of the permanent or out of storage, I should say.
It's harder, but it's possible. For instance, corporate sponsors have been supporting for some years at the Tate Gallery complete rehangs of the collection, making the permanent collection news. That's a great thing to do. So just because it's more difficult, it doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the lines to Cambridge now. And Joe's on the line. Joe, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I wanted to mention a little anecdote. Bernard Berenson was an agent for Samuel Cress many years ago, and acquired for him a nativity by Giorgione. And, of course, Cress was the five-and-dime magnate, and he bought the painting from Berenson, and it was around Christmas time, and he put the painting in the window of a Cress five-and-dime on, I believe it was Fifth Avenue, for the entire public to see and stop by and look at, and I think it was a wonderful idea. I don't have any objection to it, and
I've not heard the story before. Joe, do you have any idea what was written and said and thought about the exhibit at the time?
I believe Berenson was furious. I'm not sure he ever spoke to Cress again, unless Cress wanted to buy a painting from him. But I think that the general critical lean was that people were opposed to it. It was considered undignified, and that this painting should be in the window of a five and dime. But I can't agree. I think it was a wonderful thing to do, and I think it's the way art had been shown, perhaps in Florence.
You raise a very interesting point, because what I see going on to some extent in the art world at the moment is that those who are opposing innovation and change, and I think innovation and change are very important as we continue to make museums rich and wonderful places, tend to imply that art is somehow damaged by overexposure. And in truth, art is virtually defined. The greatest art is defined by its ability to survive. If art could truly be damaged by inappropriate use, no one would look any more at the Mona Lisa or Michelangelo's David, and yet they still move hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, every year. So to present your own nervousness, to project it onto the objects of art themselves, I think is a great mistake, and tends to inhibit the innovation and change that we need.
You're saying it's a mistake to say the only place you can see that is in a museum?
Yes, because art survives in all sorts of contexts. It's defined by its ability to survive. And one inappropriate use doesn't, in truth, damage art, and I don't think Mr. Cress was wholly wrong-headed in doing what he was doing. He brought art to the people.
And Jim, you'll face this when you move to Chicago. Someone will say to you, let's take a Van Gogh from the Art Institute of Chicago and hang it in the visitors' gallery of the Chicago Board of Trade. Lots of traffic in there. What would your first sort of gut response be to a proposal like that?
Well, who would know? But my gut response is no, there's no need to. Already the Art Institute of Chicago gets well over 1 million people coming through its doors to see the works of art that are on view there. There's no need to take work out and to put it some other place for the simple reason of trying to get more people to see it. I mean, it's you know, 1.5 million is good. 5 million in the Metropolitan is extraordinary, unbelievable. A lot of people do come to museums, and when works of art are not in museums, they can't be seen by those who regularly come. And I do think that, and it is something maybe especially the case in Chicago, is that the local regard for the museum is based on a sense of ownership, of public ownership of that institution and of its collection, and they want it to be there. They want, because they have pride in its being there, and it's been a very important part of their lives and the lives of their children and their grandchildren and so forth. So one wants to remove it only under exceptional cases, and one has to judge on a set of criteria what determines those exceptional cases, whether it's the advancement of knowledge or scholarship or bringing back works of art that have been separate from each other over many, many centuries for this rare opportunity to see them again, whatever reason. But just to take it out and put it to some other place to attract other people to it seems to be an unnecessary risk taken. It's commonly said that no work of art has ever returned from having been loaned elsewhere in better condition than when it left. And that we have to recognize, that there's always inherent some risk in moving a work of art.
How do you cope with that?
It's our job to balance the risks and the advantages. And I would say each case is different, but I think it's possible to inhibit good new developments, innovations in museums by being too cautious. I've noticed that, Jim, you can perhaps comment on this, but a number of the reviewers of your book have said that there's a great deal of hand-wringing and nervousness in its pages from a culture, about a culture which is essentially very, very strong and has lasted now for over 100 years, the museum culture. And I wish we could both do something together to restore a really positive attitude towards innovation and change that strengthened what we're doing and really helped us to fulfill some of those major issues of public trust.
We will actually pick that up as soon as we come back after our break, which will give you, Jim, a moment to think about it, and our listeners also a chance to take to the telephones. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What about the museum culture? Is there such a thing? What about the public trust and your access to the art? If you want to see it, are you happy with the way that you're able to see it now? Do you like the idea of art coming outside the museum? And what do you think the responsibility of the directors are in this case? What do you want from your art museum? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Here with me in the Boston studio, the director of the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, Malcolm Rogers, joining us from a BBC studio in London, the director of the Courtauld Institute of Art in London, James Cuno. James, your response to the suggestion here from Malcolm that there's too much of a museum culture, what do you make of that?
I don't remember that, actually, that part of it. What I remember was the thrust of the question that Malcolm asked was with regard to innovation and change. And I don't want people to think that this book is somehow a conservative book that is resistant to change, because it rather, I think, it's a radical book in the sense of going back to roots and origins. I mean, innovation doesn't move in only one direction. The Renaissance, for example, was a great innovation which returned to the classical past to reinvigorate the present. And so what I think we want to do is to not lose track of those things that remain, but perhaps have been misplaced as important to museums, and to reconsider them in the light of the current situation. So, but can I say one other thing about these conditions of looking at whether the work of art is to be seen in a trading center, or to be seen in a department store, or to be seen near to a casino, or within a casino for that matter. Looking at works of art, especially in the age in which we live, is an opportunity to give people the chance to see extraordinary connections between what might otherwise seem to be very disparate things, and to help us understand that we belong to this great family of humanity that has created these things, and this is a common cultural heritage. And I'm reminded of Edward Said in his most recent, just before he died, in his most recent preface to his book, Orientalism. said that rather than the manufactured clash of civilizations, we need to concentrate on the slow working together of cultures that overlap, borrow from each other, and live together in far more interesting ways than any abridged or inauthentic mode of understanding can allow. But for that kind of wider perception, we need time and patient and skeptical inquiry, supported by faith in communities of interpretation that are difficult to sustain in a world demanding instant action and reaction. And those of us who wrote this book do think the museum, as opposed to a gallery in a department store or a casino or some other place, offers an opportunity by which those connections can be made in the context of slow looking and thinking and discussing. And it's a very important time now to use the museum for that purpose, I think.
1-800-423-8255 to Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Catherine's on the line. Catherine, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I actually just had a comment. I actually used to be in the art history field, and I ended up leaving because a lot of frustration I often had with what I felt was snobbery, not only on the part of art historians, but also on artists. One of your previous callers was talking about how the museum should have a certain atmosphere, and while I do believe in the incredible importance of the intellectual and the spiritual aspects of art, I also feel that a lot of the people who go to the museums are often the same million or so people over and over again, and a lot of times you really have to break out of the box and really reach out to bring in people who wouldn't normally view art or go to see different types of art. A show like Guitars might inspire someone to walk around a museum and see one of the very minor shows on either furniture or stitching or something like that, and I just feel like a lot of times these limitations we place ourselves in are really depriving a lot of our fellow people, Americans all around the world, from seeing a lot of beautiful art.
Well, Catherine, you were on the inside, involved in art history. What was it about seeing it from the other side that made you think that that snobbery was a part of the institutions?
I was on the academic end of things, so I didn't actually work in a museum.
Okay.
But it was almost as though some people, and I'm not saying all people, felt that art was for people who only truly could fully understand and appreciate art. There wasn't room for people to just look at art and see it as something beautiful, something attractive, and there wasn't a lot of willingness to look at other forms of art. A lot of times, people who felt that anything that wasn't purely artistic, anything that was functional, really fully art and didn't really deserve a place in a museum. And I just found that incredibly frustrating because I felt like it was really limiting both the field and also the public.
Malcolm,
let me
start with Malcolm here in Boston and just see whether or not you think that there is that elitism that Catherine's describing as a part of the field.
There's definitely the perception, so I share a lot of her concerns.
Whether it's real or not, people think that.
There is absolutely the perception, and I think that's one of the things that relates most closely to this issue of the public trust. How do we get rid of the perception of elitism? If I could just address the other side of the coin, something that occurs regularly in this book is the idea that there are museums somewhere that have become miraculously theme parks in recent years. As far as I can tell, this is a total myth. Museums are changing very, very slowly. Let's look at the reality and then try and change that reality subtly to make sure that people like Catherine feel comfortable within our walls.
Jim.
Could I respond to two things? One thing that Catherine said about the sort of lack of humor found in museums, or at least in the people who profess to be professionals working in museums. I couldn't agree more. There is every reason to find humor in works of art and to enjoy the experience of laughing before works of art. Jeff Koons is an hilariously funny artist and ought to be appreciated for that. So I certainly agree. Museums ought to be places to which people go for a variety of reasons, and those reasons could be for learning, they could be for inspiration, they could be for inspiration, they could be for some spiritual revival, they could be for a good time, for pleasure. If I could say something about the elitism of museums, I think what's different, there's a difference between museums that seeming to be elite and museums that seem to be in pursuit of some celebrity status, and I think that too often there have been occasions by which museums, and you see this in the kinds of people that museums might get to narrate the audio guide or to be there at the opening and have the pictures taken and being in newspapers and so forth, that it isn't the case that museums are making a virtue out of a kind of broad popular appeal as often as they are seen to be in the press, making a virtue out of being in the company of well-dressed, well-known individuals. So it's not necessarily elite that one's concerned about, but celebrity.
Okay, but what about Catherine's suggestion that there is that sector of the public that goes to the museum, and then there's all the rest of the people who don't go to the museum? Does she have something there?
Well, she may, but we also have to realize that there's no reason why everybody should want to go to a museum. I didn't go to a museum until I was in my 20s. I didn't come from a family that went to museums. I don't think my father would ever have gone to a museum if I hadn't have worked in a museum, and I don't think his life was diminished by not having found pleasure in museums. Not everybody goes to every cultural activity or every political activity, has the same interest in the world. What museums need to do is to remove the number of obstacles in the way that prevent people from wanting to come into museums to engage with works of art. That's our goal. But we shouldn't worry that not everybody is interested in museums. It is a resource that's available for anyone, but it isn't a resource that requires that everyone take advantage of it.
The key word is welcome, I think, isn't it, Jim, that people should feel welcome? And that's one of the reasons why the MFA is open 7 days a week now, making it perfectly plain that the museum is run for the benefit of the public. But I do think it's one of those real challenges that many people who pass by on the pavement outside all our museums feel there's no place for them inside. Do I have to wear special clothes? How much does it cost? You know, is it for people like me? Somehow we have to be able to assure a broader public than we have succeeded in doing that there is something for them in the museum that can change their lives.
You know, Malcolm's quite right, and I think that has to start. It's best when it started early, but it should be something that we engage our public in at any age of that public. We need to find ways to make people feel, insecure when they walk into expensive clothing stores, or insecure when they walk into places with any kind of place in which they're not familiar. We need to find ways to make people feel like the museum is really an open and inviting institution. I think Malcolm's quite right.
To Bristol, Rhode Island. Now Mildred's on the line. Mildred, thank you for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that I was really lucky. I'm 73, but my sister and I were brought up in working class Detroit. Our father was a factory worker, and as soon as we got old enough to go on the bus, we would, with our two friends, go down to the Art Institute downtown, and it was free. And we would go on a Saturday and just wander around. And I don't know what made us do that, but we did it, and we did it over and over again, and we didn't go on tours or get books. We educated ourselves on what the art was there. We got favorites. We always had to go see Watson and the Shark, and, you know, we visited our favorite paintings, and we'd get postcards and put them up on our wall, and posters. And in a way, you know, I don't know if I'd be interested in art these days today.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, Mildred, whether or not you think that kids today would have that same opportunity. I mean, in some cases, no, because
no,
it'll
it's
cost
too expensive.
Some money to get.
I mean, this was free. We would go and we'd have lunch in the courtyard, and it was so elegant. And it was, you know, we were in a concrete jungle where we grew up, and it was a wonderful place to go. And then we'd go to Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills, which is a work of art in itself, and see the wonderful design. And I think design is an art, and I think if you have, and we see the cars on the street, and I see those cars today, the old Packards and the Cords and everything, and to me, that's art. You know, my
Mildred, let me step in here, because I think Malcolm Rogers, you cut admission.
Well, admission for kids at the MFA is free, I'm delighted to say.
But does it bring kids in? Do kids come in and wander around?
We would like to see more, but they do. And actually, at the moment, it's school vacation week, so the whole place is packed with kids,
right,
with their parents having a tremendous time. Something that Mildred said rang a bell with me, because my first museum visit was with my mother, and I didn't come from a particularly educated or privileged background, but I used to have to visit hospital as a kid in the nearby city of Leicester. And as a reward, she would take me to the museum after I'd been to the hospital. It's a great way to start. I was keener on stuffed squirrels in those days, but I did look at some paintings as well.
Jim, it was in Europe, traveling in Europe, when you ventured first through the portal of a museum. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And it was primarily because I was, at this point, ready. And I was curious, and I was sort of ready to to walk into a museum. And partly being a tourist, I think, just back to the point that Malcolm and I were discussing about welcoming, one of the things about being a tourist is you can put yourself in a strange place, and the anonymity of doing so encourages your participation in some way. And maybe if you're thought you're supposed to be familiar with it, if it's your local museum and you haven't gone, you might feel, in fact, like you have not been invited to go. But as a tourist, you move in and out of all these strange places.
At one point struck you. What was that? One moment in a museum got you launched in what is now a career as a director.
Well, there wasn't one thing by any means, but there was. I came to the museum at a time in which I was ready to take advantage of a museum. If I had gone when I was 12 or 13, I wouldn't have. And people are ready at different ages in their lives, and I just came at the right time. I do, however, recall very, very clearly, not a museum, but my eighth grade art teacher, and I recall, named Mr. Bugner. Sorry that he had that name. Before a bunch of kids who were 13, but nevertheless he did. And what I remember about him was the magic that he made possible for us by teaching us a two-point perspective in which on a flat piece of paper we somehow created the illusion of three dimensions. And I've never forgotten that experience, and maybe there was something when I finally got to a museum 10 years later or 12 years later that I remembered the magic of that moment.
And Malcolm Rogers, as the man in charge of the MFA, can you preserve that quiet contemplative space and still, you know, bring in an exhibit that people will line up for and please everybody?
Absolutely. We have quiet contemplative spaces throughout the museum. If you go to our Japanese temple room, for instance, or if I could tell you an anecdote, we recently had a volunteer working on our information desk who was newly trained, and someone came to her and said, tell us where the meditation room is here at the museum, and obviously the correct answer would probably have been the Japanese temple room, and she had no idea, and she said, try the English silver gallery. The man came back 2 hours later and said, best meditation I've ever had.
New way of looking at it. Malcolm, thank you so much for coming in to be with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Malcolm Rogers is director of the Museum of Fine Arts. Jim Cuno, thank you so much for your time.
Many thanks. Jim, bye, Malcolm.
Bye.
Jim's director of the Courtauld Institute of Art in London and editor of a book we were discussing on the program today called Whose Muse? Art Museums in the Public Trust. Special thanks today to Paul McGuire at the BBC for his technical assistance. And today, our program, The Connection, bids goodbye to Orit Karitsky-Fox, an esteemed producer and friend here at the program. We will miss her. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.